It's Illum Group's Andrea Lay, PacView's Melissa Burdick, the Wizard of Woodland Hills, Sri, and I'm PVSB from Flywheel, a division of Omnicom, and I'm coming to you today from the Catskills. I'll be playing Heckingers Tuesdays and Thursdays. Before we get to the CBG Guys episode you've downloaded, it's the week of May 6th, and it's time for the Fresh Four. Four curated news stories from the past week. We find them dependably intriguing. We hope you do too. We're brought to you through our partnership with RetailWit, your one-stop shop for retail industry intelligence news. RetailWit.com. It's retail right now. Over to you, Sri.
In case you're wondering what this background is, I'm at my father-in-law's house all the way in Chennai, India for the next couple of weeks. So what's the message of the week? Kroger Precision Marketing strikes a partnership with none other than Yahoo DSP. So Yahoo DSP advertisers now have access to KPM's audiences for both reach and measurement. Partnership marks KPM's second DSP partnership since last fall and ushers in a new focus on commerce media for Yahoo advertising in particular. Collaborations like this one will define the next phase of growth in retail media as retailers recognize the limitations of monetization on their own digital properties and seek incremental growth by expanding offsite. This is said by Sara Marzano, principal analyst at eMarketer. For advertisers, the delayed but still impending deprecation of third-party cookies, which is now on its way, continues to underpin every decision regarding digital advertising dollars. So solutions that safeguard their investments against that will hold increasing appeal. Over to you, Andrea.
Hello, Fresh Four listeners. Walmart adds a new grocery line to its private brands portfolio. Walmart has announced a new private label grocery brand called Better Goods. The line includes 300 items spanning categories such as frozen, dairy, snacks, beverages, pasta, soups, coffee, and chocolate. With most items priced under $5, Better Goods focuses on three key components: culinary experiences, plant-based, and made without. The retailer said Better Goods marks not only its largest private food brand launch in two decades, but also its fastest grocery brand brought to market. Over to you, Melissa.
Thanks, Andrea. So Save Mart companies roll out in-store retail media networks. It's not enough that we have online. Now we're moving to in-store retail media networks. The Save Mart companies plans to roll out In-Store Connect, an in-store retail media network powered by Quad Graphics Inc. To start, 16 of the grocery company stores will have digital screens, kiosks, end caps, shelf screens, and vertical banners throughout, allowing CPG partners to showcase promotions, product information, and recommendations to shoppers. The program will eventually roll out to all of the Save Mart companies, approximately 200 stores. This is Save Mart's latest retail media effort, coming almost a year after a launch of its own retail media network. Over to you, Peter.
Thanks, Melissa. Rite Aid expands Uber Eats partnership for alcohol delivery in 8 states. Nearly 1,000 Rite Aid stores will now offer alcohol delivery via retailers' expanded partnership with Uber Eats. Customers of legal drinking age can get delivery from select stores in California, Idaho, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Virginia, and Washington. Quote, our collaboration and trusted partnership with Uber Eats underscores our commitment to meet the evolving needs of our customers and providing a seamless digital shopping experience that complements their busy lives, unquote, said Jeannie Walden, Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer at Rite Aid, the U.S.'s third largest pharmacy retailer. That's it for the Fresh Four. Now on to the CPG Guys episode that you've downloaded. Welcome to another episode of the CPG Guys podcast. Our hosts, Sri Rajagopalan, Peter V.S. Bond, and Brian Gildenberg, explore how brands and retailers engage consumers in an increasingly digitally driven world. And now, here are the CPG Guys.
Hello, welcome to the CPG Guys podcast, where we explore the omnichannel digital journey of brands and retailers. I'm your host, Brian Gildenberg, coming to you live from Las Vegas as we record this during Grocery Shop 2023. When not podcasting, I serve as the founder and CEO of Confluencer Commerce and the managing director of North America for Retail Cities. Also the host of the CPG Guys Fast Forward podcast and the Gildenberg Omni Comment every Thursday. I apologize for just being me today and my guest, who we'll get to in a minute. But our co-hosts are busy roaming the world, either within the grocery shop itself or parts unknown in the case of Sri. And we'll be, but today it's just me solo with our guests. So, but before we get to the guest, I'll remind everybody to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform. If you use Apple or Spotify, please give us a rating. Helps fuel the algorithm, and makes our podcast more findable. We want to express how honored we are to be rated the number one CPG podcast for 2 years running, according to FeedSpot, the leading podcast ranking authority, and we are very pleased to have joining us in the top 30 our sister podcast, the CPG Scoop, CPG Guys Fast Forward, and the FMCG Guys. We're also thrilled and happy to be formal sponsors of Next Up, whose mission is to advance all women in business. We are giving away memberships to this prestigious network and organization, so drop us a line at contact@cpgguys.com to learn more and take advantage of what Next Up has to offer if you are a successful female founder. Links to our podcast, our sister cast, and our landing page on Next Up may be found in the digital liner notes of this episode. But for now, dispensing with the preamble, let's get to the main event. So today, our guest comes to us from Nielsen IQ. We joined the Nielsen IQ organization in 2023 with really deep experience in data, branding, and insights. Earlier this year, he assumed the role of the SVP of Wellness and Sustainability for Nielsen IQ. As a reminder, we've had two other episodes of Nielsen IQ on the CPG Guys, and find them on your favorite podcast platform if you're curious to learn more by typing CPG Guys and IQ. Or on our website, cpgguys.com. You can search away and figure all that out. So please join me today in welcoming to the podcast our guest, Jim Presley. Jim, great to be with you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. Thank you so much for having me. I've been a longtime listener and advocate of the CPG Guys. One of the things I love about our industry is it's so dynamic and haven't found a better platform to stay abreast of all the changes. So great to be here.
Well, we appreciate the kind words, and fortunately, on camera, they won't show me giving you money for that as we unfold throughout the podcast. Before we get to the questions I prepared, just give us the description of your role at NIQ. So,
yeah, as the SVP GM of Sustainability and Wellness, NIQ really sits on a pretty fantastic acquisition portfolio over the last few years, and one of those acquisitions was BrandBank, which is really all about content and deep and rich product content.
Yes.
Really generated from a variety of sources.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another acquisition, Label Insights, who the CPG Guys have covered in a prior episode.
Yep.
And really that was all the translation of that product-rich attribute data, but then taking it beyond what we would say like a stated attribute. So what do brands and manufacturers actually put on the package? And going a much layer deeper to the ingredients, the supplements, the fact panels, and going through a translation to ascertain things that a brand or product may stand for, but they don't have the capacity or have chosen not to place it on the product. And that just creates a massive library of rich attribute data that goes way beyond the UPC itself.
Yeah.
And then we just marry that up with all the rich market measurement data that NIQ has. And I'm responsible for all of the teams that support those businesses and those efforts to then take that data, commingle it, and produce what we call like new dimensions in market research to understand trends that may happen outside of a brand dimension and more at the attribute or lifestyle standpoint.
Wow, that's fascinating. As sort of both by accident but also by interest, as a research nerd alert, obviously having spent a fair chunk of my career at Kantar trying to help figure out how to solve some of these issues, this stuff just sounds fascinating. I really look forward to unpacking it further as we get into this. So as we sort of move into our conversation, just a note before we do that, the digital liner notes of this episode, we're going to include links to your LinkedIn profile, the Nielsen IQ LinkedIn page, as well as to Nielsen IQ's website for our listeners to access and to get more information on what we're talking about within our conversation. So let's start. Jim, you've had an interesting career and you've done a number of different things. You've worked in the data industry for a while. You've worked with Altria. You've worked with Catalina. Now you're heading Total Wellness and Sustainability for NIQ. Why don't you take us a little bit through the journey of how you got there, why you chose NIQ at this particular moment in time, and why now in this space?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I was fortunate to grow up and start my career in the CPG industry and start with a big manufacturer. And really that afforded me a lot of great introductions to all the disciplines that I think helped my career today. So category management, sales leadership, analytics. And that organization put a lot of investment and a lot of tutelage behind training and development. It just created a great foundation as I went further in my career.
Right.
After that experience, I had a lot of passion for how do we turn data into things that are ROI defensible, right? And I think the ability to understand how different data inputs can have a massive impact on how consumers are engaged and how manufacturers may utilize some of those assets was really a foundational experience at Catalina and in the ad tech industry. As later in my tenure there, I had the fortunate ability to not only look after commercial functions, but also have dotted line to product. And that was kind of my first interest into really trying to marry the needs of development and technology with the needs of the client and the industry. And it really fueled my passion for more of a cross-functional scope as I moved in my career.
Interesting. I like that phrase, ROI defensible. I mean, it's a really interesting way to frame up the challenge and the opportunity from a data point of view. And so today, from an NIQ point of view, what's got you really jazzed up about where you are?
You know, I'm a big believer in software and all the great tools that NIQ has. One limitation of software is that it doesn't talk well with other data sets.
Right.
And given the complexity of our industry and how modern our consumers are becoming, very few singular data sets can answer all of the questions and needs of any large brand or CPG.
Right.
And what I love about NIQ is while we have great software tools, we are building data as a service engines. And given the acquisition strategy that we have with the help of our partner Advent, we now have all of these highly valuable assets in their raw form. And I almost feel like a puzzle or a chef, right? Mm-hmm. Where I'm trying to figure out different ways to merge and enhance the underlying assets into something that's bigger and more powerful in a combined fashion.
Oh, that's fascinating too. And I like that chef metaphor because I use that a lot to talk about the difference between data scientists, who I would describe as chefs, mm-hmm. and data engineers who make food, right? And the journey to think about how to integrate all that data in a way that's useful, that's got to be just a fascinating one, right? Like how do you think about what the right degree of integration is and how all that process works? How's that journey going for you guys?
It's fascinating, and I'm learning every day and have great teams to support. But you know, it all has to start from a guided path that is not yours. My opinion is that if you're chasing down a path that's only yours, it's a hobby.
Right, yeah.
Right, and so getting really close to our clients, getting really close to industry thought leaders like yourself,
yeah.
What are the needs of the business? What are the needs of the industry? And then how do we work backwards from that and stitch together different recipes of data and technology to go deliver upon those?
Yeah, I can't remember. This sounds like a Mark Twain quote, but I'm not sure it was him. But the guy, whoever it was that said, a leader without followers is just a guy out taking a walk. I've always enjoyed that. So let's talk a little bit more now about the specific vertical you're exploring within IQ, which is sustainability. This is not a new concept. It's been around for a while. You know, it's got its roots in the environmental movement, which goes back to, I'm old enough to remember, the Native American with the tear rolling down his cheek, looking at the pile of, looking at the dump and the 1970s EPA ad. So this stuff's been around for, you know, 50, 60 years in some way, shape, or form. But today, I think there's some simplistic narratives around this, i.e. younger consumers are more interested in this stuff. A certain percentage of consumers have kind of shifted their behavior in that general direction. But at the same time, you know, just looking around this room, right? I mean, we haven't gotten rid of glass, plastic, or cardboard in the world because I can see a ton of it just staring at it here. Where is this going? Like, how does your data reveal the consumer attitudes that are most important in the space, I guess, would be the question I would have. So,
yeah, I think our position is sustainability is not going away.
No.
It's only going to intensify.
Yes.
But we have some competing forces right now.
Right.
The first competing force is you have a consumer base that is, like you said, Brian, getting younger,
yep.
who is more conscious and cautious on the brands that they choose to invest in based upon beyond the functional needs of the product and what do they do beyond the product? What do they stand for? You also have a lot of manufacturers.
Can I just pause you there for a second? Because cautious is such an interesting word because everybody always talks about the upside with it. And like brands have to lean in and consumers are going to lean in with them. But talk a little bit more about that caution thing. What do you think that means?
What's driving it for us is recent research that says 77, and this number was fascinating to me.
Yeah.
77% of consumers will stop buying a brand immediately mm-hmm. if they suspect they're evident of greenwashing.
Wow.
Which means talking beyond what their product does or delivers upon from a sustainability lens.
Yeah.
And that's such a high percentage, and that just shows a conviction.
Right.
And I think that's why I choose the word cautious, because while there is upside, there's also a responsibility to defend and continue to delight and live up to the promise you've made to your existing base.
Well, and it's a great word too, because as I said, I don't think, I think brands get into the stuff sometimes and they don't think about the downside of poor participation, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I've been in meetings where people are like, well, we should do something. Well, this isn't very much the phrase, well, it's better than nothing comes up a lot. It's like, you know what? Maybe it's not. There may be something worse than nothing, actually, which is mm-hmm. which is the perception of greenwashing, which is really fascinating.
And the other side of that is, I think what's in conflict with it is we are in a inflationary environment that is not yes. new news. And so I think what you start to find is that the say-do gap continues to widen.
Right. Yes.
I want this. I want products that are in my house to stand for this.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, government funds may have run out from my discretionary income.
Yeah.
Everything has a higher cost, and you have to make tough choices from a discretionary standpoint.
Well, and I think that's always fascinating when you can tie attitudes to observed behaviors, and mm-hmm. you see the lack of correlation with that. I mean, I've worked in market research for years as well, and one of the things we always had is like people, particularly around shopping, particularly about anything related to value, they always fill out the survey like their mother's watching them. So they're always way more conscious about their decisions than they actually are. Mom's gonna see that, but in real life, you know, I'll go downstairs and instead of ordering water on Instacart, I'll go pay $9 a bottle for it in the convenience store down here. Because I can, that's how you people actually behave. When you look at some of the like sort of the two drivers, I guess, or a couple of drivers of what makes sustainability marketing work, like how do you think about what are the brands that have the highest potential for it? I guess
I think that the first recognition and something that is potentially oftentimes overlooked or just not apparent is sustainability as a word is an umbrella word.
Yes.
Right. And if you would ask 100 consumers what they mean or what they feel towards sustainability, you'll probably get 100 different answers.
Yeah.
And so step one is to drill down one layer below. Does that mean biodegradable? Does that mean recyclable? Does that mean free from pet, animal welfare? Like what's the underlying component
right.
within sustainability that does a couple things? That A, aligns with your brand positioning and your brand promise. B, aligns with your consumers. And then C, the very important component that once again is not always heavily researched is anything that you would do under sustainability most likely is going to carry higher input costs
right,
as
yeah.
a manufacturer.
Right.
And so does that attribute or does that more detailed definition of sustainability that aligns with your consumer, is there evidence of price premium in the marketplace?
Right.
Can you make back what you're having to invest in to justify the business case?
Yeah. And I think that's a big one. It's a good, honest recognition of what the business problem actually is. I do think that there's a number of brands in the world that have been successful at trying to create a sustainability aura, but also have a slightly more value-based positioning. Like I'm pretty familiar over the years with Hello, the toothpaste brand that Colgate bought a few years ago. Like that was one of those brands that grew up with a halo of sustainability, partially because it was just kind of looked sustainable and they talked a lot about it, which is great. But also try to maintain a more value-centric position. But for the most part, yeah, I think you're looking at this. Anyway, I could ramble about this all day. So, but you're the guest, so let's not do that. So I think that's good. That's really cool. And then as you look at this, I guess we'll use COVID as a prompt for this. But like over the last few years, and COVID's probably got something to do with this. What changes have you seen in sustainability? Are consumers Did consumers think more or less about it in terms of like what their carbon footprint was? Are they adjusting more? How do you think that the disruption that we've all gone through over the last couple of years, how's that impacted consumer attitudes to sustainability?
You know, Brian, because you come from the same space for 30 years, when you ask consumers what was important, it was price.
Yeah.
And then it was price again.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
Well, or you asked them what was important, they said something else, and then when you looked at their behavior, it was price. So, so that's more to the point.
but we see sustainability and cause-based marketing continue to creep up. 61% of consumers now say that they feel the current environment and the impact that we're all making to the environment is causing significant harm on them and their families.
Yeah.
And they say, 64% of them, that they're willing to pay more.
Right.
And so that's created this, once again, greater adoption, greater awareness. And I think it even intensifies when you go to some of the younger generations. I can share a few stats there.
Yep.
But the awareness has never been more top of mind. But that's where that friction comes from, is not every manufacturer has gone down the path of justifying the business case that then supports that.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's the I think that that's the interesting rub, right? Because I think that 64% say they're willing to pay more. Some subset of that are willing. And the other thing is that it's contextual, right? So again, you and I both sat in meetings where people put a number like that up, and it's like, oh, well, we can. It's like, yeah, they're willing to pay more, but that doesn't mean they're going to, right? Like, I'm willing to do a lot of things I don't do.
There's a fascinating stat if we just go to the vitamin category for a second.
Sure.
So vitamin category as a whole is actually down 0.7% versus last year.
Right.
Interesting. Now, if you look at total sustainability.
Dollars or units?
Dollars.
Okay.
You look at total sustainability actually isn't doing much better.
Right.
When you attach it to those sustainable brands within VMS.
Right.
However, if you look at BPA-free, bisphenol, which is a harmful product or chemical in a lot of plastic bottles, that is growing at many, many factors more than the category. And it's just a clear delineation that you have to go lower than sustainability and find that core attribute that actually is driving growth and is driving price premiumization.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, there are so many products in the vitamin category that appear to have green leaves on them as a way to convey naturalness for a pill that was made in a lab, which is like, it's like, does people walk through the vitamin category think this stuff grows on trees? Like, I don't really necessarily understand that value proposition, but that's pretty interesting. So I think the other thing is that when you look at, when you kind of look at how consumers are like searching for and finding things, like what are some of the themes that you see when you look from maybe it's from an e-commerce point of view about how shoppers are looking at sustainability? What are they looking for when they go? Are they looking for specific brands? Are they looking for the term? How do they process that?
Yeah, I'm glad you went there, because that's another gap I think in this journey is just discoverability.
Yeah.
So two data points that sit really true with me as I think about my job and how to better affect my world is 75% of all discovery today happens online, which is not terribly surprising given COVID, right? And 78% of all Amazon searches are unbranded.
Wow.
They're searching for lifestyles. They're searching for sustainability. They're searching for those things that they attach and they connect with, less about the brand itself.
Yeah.
You carry that through. 87% of brands fail to claim one of the top three attributes that their brand actually does live up for.
Yes.
And so it becomes even more challenging that even if you did go down the path of investing in higher source materials to become more sustainable, you've done all that legwork, you've invested all that CapEx,
right?
And now you can't connect it to the consumers who actually are going to make the decision.
Sure.
Breaks the model very quickly.
Yeah. You forget to take credit for the work that you're doing. And that's, that's interesting. So, and this will build into something, and this is an observation that I've made that our Fresh Four co-host, Andrea Lay, is very good about reminding all of us, particularly me, about, which is that if you look at now Gen Z, right, and how they behave, you've got a really different pattern there. Like, I saw a number the other day, I think 71% of Gen Z product searches today don't start on Google or on Amazon. They actually start on TikTok.
Yeah.
And so you've got like, so when you think about that and you just think about Gen Z in general, what's some of the impact that you see Gen Z having on brands? Is it packaging? Is it in consumption? How does the perception of what Gen Z wants and what Gen Z actually wants, is that changing brands in any way that's particularly meaningful from your point of view?
It is. You know, we took a really deep look at this. And we actually, before you even looked at it by demo, we first cut the consumer bases by overall spend on sustainability.
Right.
We didn't want to just focus on the higher spenders to maybe give like a imperfect view of the marketplace.
Right.
So even if you look at the lowest percentage, so the bottom third of sustainable spending households in the US.
Yep.
The ages from 18 to 34, they're spending 36 basis points higher than the other demos. And so if you look at how that group becomes a greater in prevalence as they get older, and assuming that their discretionary income and their purchasing power gets higher, it's only going to become more important that brands find the right way to connect back to sustainability.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be their target consumer if it's not already today.
Well, and my observation is, I was just thinking about it, it's occurred to me now, but like, if you think about like the formative experience, I'm old, right? So the formative experience of, for me growing up, like if the thing we were terrified of growing up in the 70s and early 80s was nuclear war, right? Like there was the day, the movie The Day After, which showed the entire world obliterated by nuclear war. I mean, I'm not old enough to remember the fallout shelter drills. I think by that point we realized that a nuclear bomb was going to blow the crap out of everything. So we didn't bother doing that anymore. But my mom remembers that. But that was like our global fear, and it really colored everything that we, you know, the whole Cold War, you know, Rocky IV, all of this came out of a fear of nuclear annihilation. That was the overwhelming existential fear that we had. Kids are growing up today, their overwhelming existential fear is that the world's going to melt, right? So, and I don't think that brands have really thought through the degree to which that really does color. Like, these are children that have grown up from the minute they could hearing that the planet is going to destroy itself. And as a result, that's deep, I think, more formative than perhaps than it's been to any other generation.
And to that point, they themselves, in my mind, almost act like mini agencies. They have so many digital touch points to then go share out their sentiment.
Yeah.
Right? So if they, obviously they've heard these things like right. about the planet you're talking about, they may have a positive or less than positive experience with a brand or right. something that supports sustainability. On their phone, they have access to numerous platforms to then go share that message in a very public and broad fashion.
Yeah.
When you and I grew up, we didn't have that ability.
No.
And so it just reinvigorates how important it is to have like the right tailored message and right. deliver upon it every time.
I like that idea of an agency of one. I think that's a really interesting way to, that's a really interesting way to think about the problem. Just a reminder to our audience that we are speaking with Jim Presley from the Nielsen IQ company. And so as we continue with this conversation, so if you think about rules, right? So what are, I mean, everybody, it's hard, particularly I think for large companies, to align against something where there's no standards. Yeah. Like it's just the way large companies incent behavior and reward is to set a standard and then try to hold people accountable to it, or to set a stretch standard and hold people accountable for achieving that standard. There's not a ton of tremendous governance in this industry right now or in this space. So what do you think's been established so far? What's good about it? What's missing? And how do you see that unfolding in the future?
You're spot on, Brian. There's not much here domestically that...
particularly the U.S.
Good yeah, Lord. Is meaningful. We are watching closely the CSRD in the EU.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the EU has said by 2050, they're going to be carbon neutral.
Right.
And what I think is pretty interesting about how they've structured that, and there's not a ton of information on it yet, but each manufacturer has these check-in points, almost like annual filings to Wall Street, that they have to report back to the EU on their progress.
Right.
And against all the gradients and standards that they've set forth.
Right.
Now, sometimes the US follows the EU and sometimes they do the complete opposite.
Yes.
Hard to assume what's going to happen. But to us, I think that feels like the most substantive piece of legislation out there.
Right.
And my guidance to any of the manufacturers I speak to is North America hasn't done that yet.
No.
And so now is the time to start testing and pressure testing.
Yeah.
What is going to be your voice in sustainability? Where can you actually justify the business case and allow you to be part of the guidance to domestic regulators on what that may look like?
Well, and I think, too, my observation would be over the years that I think the easiest way in a North American context to try to learn that stuff is not to try to learn it in the U.S., but to learn it in Canada, which has what I would just describe simply as a more European attitude towards that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you can look at, you look at sustainability, it does shape shopper behavior much more directly in Canada than it does in the U.S. Consumers care more about it, particularly some aspects of sustainability. And I think just in general, the other thing about the Canadian marketplace, which people always forget, is that because income distribution is narrower there, it's actually easier to find niches in the market for sort of like semi-premium products that have a little bit of a price premium attached to them. In the U.S., it's just really hard to land that stuff sometimes because the income distribution is so broad. If you're going to go premium here, you kind of really have to go premium because rich people can afford really premium stuff. Mm-hmm. That middle ground between good or everyday and premium is often a tough space to occupy in the U.S., whereas in Canada it's easier. So just an observation for the listeners if you're looking for a North American strategy there. So I think the next sort of thought that I had, if you're, and this is a conversation we'd started on a little bit earlier, but I'd love to sort of explore in a little bit more detail now, which is when you're talking about search attributes, when we were talking about the discoverability and findability in the e-commerce world and how if searches are unbranded, how do brands, or how would you think brands can do a better job of that? And are consumers consistent at all in terms of how they're trying to discover sustainability?
Yeah, you know, there are sophisticated tools out there, and NIQ has a few of them to try to normalize the different nomenclature that may be associated with sustainability in a search function and kind of bring that back and group it into sustainability or recycled. I think that's kind of step one.
Yeah.
But then I think actually that the next step that brands can do is have a really strong partnership with their retailers and their .com platforms. I won't name the retailers, Brian, but we looked at three major U.S. retailers who have relatively a similar assortment.
Yep.
And you type in the word sustainability, retailer one returns 6 items, retailer two returned 14,
yep,
and retailer three returned 120.
Okay.
Now, if you're a household and sustainability is important to you from a cause or a lifestyle standpoint, obviously you're going to gravitate to retailer three.
Right.
And so I think that's where our data can be so foundational to not only guide insights from an R&D standpoint, but also act as a mechanism for consumer discoverability and hopefully conversion to map it then to any of those .com platforms where the brands are, you know, showcasing their products.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, because I think the 120 might be more attractive for the active consumer, but the 6 or the 14 might be more attractive for somebody that's not as engaged in the category and can't sift through that many choices. So
sure.
I wonder if that doesn't sound like something somebody's doing on purpose, but there might be an argument for the designing it so that you're actually managing choice a little bit more effectively for the consumer. And as you well know, having been in the data world for a while, sometimes 120 choices is not better than 6.
Right.
Sometimes it's markedly worse in terms of helping the shopper try to figure out what it is they're actually trying to do. So
that's a great point on personalization.
Yeah.
Right? It's like,
okay, yeah,
but personalization, I think, has to come from the basis of full data capture, right, in market coverage.
Right.
Because then from there, you can actually pare it down and tailor it. But you have to start from a point of high coverage.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And I think, personalization is one of those things that, I think people get really hyped up about it until you begin to realize that, one person selling thing to one person is not modern commerce. It's a lemonade stand, right? So, nobody's IPOing that. So the idea is somehow that I've got to create some sort of efficiency in personalization, and whether that's, and everybody always talks about AI and granularity and all the other stuff, but I think the other way that you can personalize is just simply to identify something that's, unique and important to more than one person, and then you deliver it to them and it feels personalized to them, but it may not be. So yeah. I think what oftentimes brands get confused by is when people ask for personalization, what they're really asking for is relevance, right? So I just make it relevant for me. Like, I don't really care if I get something different than that person does. I don't dislike them. I don't dislike you. Like, I don't care if I get a different offer than you. I just want to make sure it makes sense for me. But I love that idea around that. Now, we've talked a lot about kind of the setup here. So we've we've done all the ritual, we've done the amuse-bouche, we've done the appetizer course, but now let's get to the main course. What is NIQ actually doing in this space from a sustainability and wellness point of view? What are the solutions that you're bringing to the table to help help your clients navigate through this ecosystem?
Yeah, so step one, what we've done is we've taken all of this rich attribute data. We can actually see up to 1,300 unique attributes across of roughly 95% of FMCG coverage here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And we've married that both inside of software and then externally in a data feed or a data extract standpoint to all of the market measurement data that you know from NIQ.
Okay.
And so when I think about what we're trying to do, I think it's beyond just sustainability. I view my job as trying to add a new dimension to market research, right? Everything that we do today from a branding or marketing standpoint or category captain is category and then brand.
Yeah.
Right? And you're finding consumers that are becoming just simply more educated.
Right.
You're looking at ingredients. Mm-hmm. You're looking at source materials. Is this coming from a woman-owned business? Right?
Yeah.
All of those things are important.
Yeah.
And if that can't be permeated through how you think about innovation to how you manage the category to how you message and market to your brand.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that your relevance is going to keep up with the consumer knowledge.
Right. Well, no, and this gets back to what's better than listening to an old white dude talk about TikTok. But I think one of the interesting things about TikTok, of course, is that like if you go and like search for vitamins on TikTok or supplements or whatever, you'll just get somebody who's taken the label that's unreadable, blown it up, and then just talks you through it, right? And says, here's what's in this, here's what's good, here's what's not, whatever it is. And that level of what's happening, I think, with these agencies of one that you so eloquently described before, is that these agencies of one are solving for consumer problems where there's an outage between, you know, what the brand is and how the brand communicates. Mm-hmm. They're basically sort of filling the gap, if you will, that exists in the space that helps people understand that. So I love this idea that, you know, creating a broader dimension to purchase outcomes because you can tie that back to something meaningful, and you're creating a broader platform for the work around what's meaningful by being able to link it to a purchase outcome and, you know, then being able to dimensionalize both of those things. I think in this space in particular, it's so critical because, as we've discussed a couple of times already, what people say and what they do can be quite different. And
to piggyback on that, you're so right. I mean, I think you said it, you can ask them what they want, but at the end of the day, it comes down to price, right? And yeah. I'm going to date myself. There was the 4 P's of marketing, my first marketing class many years ago.
Yes.
And I think what we're trying to add is tools and data that get our clients one step closer to the actual purchase to drivers that are driving decisions today.
Right.
Right. Is it the ingredients or the lack thereof? Is it because it's free from paraben? Is it because it's aluminum based or not aluminum based? Those are all new purchase drivers that have relatively been opaque. Right, with legacy data tools.
Right.
We're trying to just connect the gap to tools and services that our clients know of us today, but then this whole new look and visibility that can make hopefully the decisions and the insights more actionable.
Well, and I think sometimes too, particularly in the wellness space, sometimes the narrative just comes out of thin air, right? Like all of a sudden something is perceived as being good or not being good that, you know, may or may not be rooted in any actual science, but there becomes a narrative around it. So like, you know, all of the rage around collagen over the last year or so is a really good example of something that just kind of grew up organically. I mean, it's a couple of years probably at this point, but because the large brands are starting to innovate to it, so it must be at least 2 or 3 years old. So, yeah. But 5 years ago, who knew what collagen was, right? Nobody, but like, and it started to explode and gain. And I think the skill I'd be curious for your thoughts on this, that the ability to assess those trends more dynamically seems like way more important than they have used to have been.
I'm glad you brought that up. I had the pleasure of being and speaking at the Plant-Based Expo here a few weeks ago.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And before my speech, I heard, I think it's 6 times.
Yeah.
Have we reached the peak of plant-based acceptance in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Because growth, while it's still growing, it has slowed.
Yeah.
And it's coming more in par with just total store growth.
Yeah.
Right? And the data is fascinating because, to your point, when you get more granular and you get closer to those purchase drivers, I think a lot of consumers had the perception when plant-based was first created that it was healthy.
Right.
I'm not saying that it's not healthy, but there are some ingredients that are and some that have less perception as far as its healthy claims and functional benefits.
Right.
And if you start to delineate the performance of plant-based in total between those plant-based items that have ingredients that are generally known to be good for you or better for you versus those ingredients that may not or have a bad perception, the delta in sales growth is 18x.
Wow.
And so I think we're at a stage where the consumer's understanding and knowledge, because of all these touch points and sources for information, may sometimes be much further than what we have given them credit for.
Right.
And meeting them there with data that is simply more actionable and granular can be a path to unlock that growth.
Well, and also discovering what the, and to the point that you've made a couple of times here, which is so important, about what the attributes actually are that people are responding to. Mm-hmm. Don't just go in with a superficial understanding of it. Really do the work, really get granular, really understand where the attributes are going and things like that. I think from a price point of view, and I use this example a lot in some of my own work, but because I think it's been this one specifically on the plant-based side. So because from a price value perspective, obviously that's where it gets out of whack. Now, I think there's an argument that the price value relationship between everyday and sort of premium in categories has altered dramatically due to inflation, mm-hmm. and that you've got an opportunity because nobody really knows what anything costs anymore, right? Because the prices have all gone. So there's an example I use in the deck because it's BioLife, right? So the plant-based mm-hmm. cheese guys, right? So they took a 7-ounce tub of plant-based cream cheese, so which is theirs, and at Walmart ran a promotion on it where it was 2 cents cheaper than the 8-ounce tub of Philadelphia cream cheese. Now, is that the everyday price? No. But what they're doing is they're taking advantage of that. The shopper no longer has price reference points and going, hey, you know what? Try this. It's the same price point. So now, you know, you're walking through the store. It's like my 15-year-old daughter's been moaning at me because she wants to be vegan, don't have this. Oh, crap, it's the same price. Okay, we'll do that, right? I'll try it. And if you can get people to try it at the existing price point, they like it. You architect them back up. Now, all of a sudden, you've used wellness as a way to sort of re-architect the economics of a category. You've taken the consumer into a higher margin product that's probably less promotionally intensive over time. So I think there's some really interesting work that your work is going to help fuel around helping brands understand what the potential is for that type of trial and what the upside could be, because I think there's enormous sort of economic impact on the other side if we can get it right. So,
yeah, and I think you've given a lot of really intelligent thought leadership in this space as well in prior episodes, that all of the switching that's happening can be creating opportunities.
Yes, it is.
Because it's causing every consumer to can reconsider what they're doing today.
Yeah.
And use that as an inflection point to stimulate penetration.
Yeah, I'll often characterize the world of 2023 as being wet cement, right? So people aren't completely fluid, but at the same time, trying to shape wet cement is way easier than trying to shape dry cement, right? Like you can do it as opposed to having to jackhammer it. So all right. Well, listen. We both have a show to get back to here, and you've got like actual work to do. So why don't we wrap up with our last question, which is always fast forward because that's my podcast, so I get to ask it. What are some of the growth trends you think you're going to see in the future? Like what's next?
I think just as we've alluded to, I think you're going to see ingredients and attributes and causes start to either be at par or outweigh some of the functional benefits from a purchase motivator and from a purchase driver standpoint. And I think it's going to be critical for brands to understand that full picture if they really want to win.
Right. So give me an example.
The best example is one we just talked about with the plant-based.
Okay, sure. Right.
Yeah. You know, like I want to go buy plant-based. Okay, we're seeing that growth start to level off.
Right.
But really where the growth is on key ingredients underneath the umbrella of plant-based.
Yeah.
No different than our sustainability conversation.
Right.
That's an umbrella topic.
Right.
But for your consumer and your category, is it about being biodegradable?
Right.
Is it about being recyclable?
Sure, yeah. Right. Well, I think it's a really great theme to kind of wrap up on, which is that everybody always talks about personalization in terms of the person. But maybe it's theization that needs to change too, right? Yeah. Like you've got to start to get way more granular about what the attributes are that you're thinking about and really understand who's going to respond to those specific attributes. And obviously then the data set that you've collected with Label Insights and Brand Bank lets you guys put that together in some really interesting and compelling ways, right? Because you can learn a ton from matching up the attributes to sales performance in really powerful ways. And then you can vary the content in some really interesting ways. I think that's going to be one of the really I think when you start to look at that, because if I'm, again, a plant-based food manufacturer, there are some shoppers who are going to respond to plant-based because they don't like dead animals. Cool. So, and that's their number one priority. There'll be shoppers within that that respond to the specific attributes or need specific attributes de-emphasized in order to encourage purchase. You're going to be able to vary that content relatively easily, and your platform's going to act as fuel for that to help people understand the specific shoppers that are responding to specific cues. So that's really cool. So
And you know, you may have consumers that aren't terribly passionate about plant-based or non-plant-based,
right?
But they may be passionate about certain ingredients or things from a healthy standpoint,
right,
that make them feel better.
Right.
And use that as an opportunity to grow penetration in plant-based.
Right.
Not because the absence of meat,
right,
but because the inclusion of certain healthy elements.
Right. Yeah. So figuring out the pros and the cons, and it gets back to one of the earlier themes you hit about the balancing act between leaning in and making sure you're not over leaning, which I think is really cool. So, a reminder to our audience that, you can find all of our great content on the cpgguys.com website, and we'll link to that, obviously, in the show notes. You can find all of our content there. And if you think your company has thought leadership to contribute to the world, please feel free to reach out to us at contact@cpgguys.com. And someday you can be sitting in a hotel room in Las Vegas talking to me, which I'm sure would be the thrill and apex of your professional career, as I'm sure it's been for Jim. Don't forget to drop us a rating on cpgguys.com or in the navigation on your favorite podcast platform. Again, makes us more findable. And as always, thank you to our more than 25,000 followers that make all this possible. So, and Jim, man, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it. This is a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Brian. This was a delight for me, and I appreciate it.
Look forward to continuing it. So I think there are a couple of big themes that came out of this as a just kind of recap. I do love that idea of the cautious consumer and 71 or 77%, I can't remember exactly, 77% of consumers that can get alienated through greenwashing, and that's incredibly important. I think the defensible ROI as a concept is one I'll borrow freely at this point to try to figure that out. I think there's a lot of the really good conversations around granularity of attribute,
yep,
and the need to get more granular in the sustainable space and in the wellness space in order to be able to facilitate and drive that. I think we had some really robust conversation around how shopper preferences are actually really starting to manifest in this category, where you now have 64% of shoppers that are willing to say that they'll spend more on things. And even if the number isn't 64%, look, if it's 6.4, it's probably worth doing. Yeah. And if it's half, it's 32. And that's a really big number. And trying to figure that out. I love the conversation around standards and trying to figure out what we can learn from Europe, which is usually very little. and then trying to figure some of that out. And I think that the last conversation, again, that we had around really understanding how attributes tie to sales performance, like, it's super critical. So look, thank you for your time, and to the audience, thanks for listening. Have a great day. So take care.
The content in this podcast episode is provided for general informational purposes only. By listening to our episode, you understand that no information contained in this episode should be construed as advice from CPG Guys LLC or the individual author, hosts, or guests, nor is it intended to be a substitute for research on any subject matter. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by CPG Guys LLC. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. The views expressed by CPG Guys LLC do not represent the views of their employers or the entity they represent. CPG Guys LLC expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, or inability to use this podcast or the information we present in this podcast.